Hello and welcome to the Tales of Osteopathy Students with me, Chelsea, and my good friend, V. How are you doing, V?
Hello, I'm good. My eye bags are the same size as my eyeballs. I'm so tired. We've just had a uni weekend and Chelsea's and my brain has yet again been blown, been put back together so that we can talk about it in some sort of sense today with you,
I mean,
lovely listeners.
You say sense, but I think sense is going to be a stretch of the imagination.
Yeah,
there'll be
the
words.
Loose definition. There will be words.
There'll be words. There might be sentences. We'll see how we do.
It's kind of a good thing that I'm don't know any other languages other than what's on a menu or a bar menu or anything like that, and to read, because otherwise I'd start speaking in different languages. Honestly, that's how messed up my brain is this morning.
Yeah, I feel you.
Yeah.
Stress.
Mm.
I fucking hate technology. I want to punch
technology. Like, are you going to say anything?
In its stupid, stupid face.
Chelsea's had a few difficulties with her new laptop this morning, and I love watching other people suffer with technology. And Chelsea's just, she has such brilliant faces when she's frustrated. It makes me laugh so much.
It's essentially my laptop. If my laptop was a person, it'd be like this. It'd be like, Chelsea, I've done a lot of fucking work this weekend and I've had enough. So no, I'm not recording your podcast today. Oh, fuck you. It's basically what my laptop would say if it had a voice right now.
Yeah, I concur. I agree.
So, apart from uni, what have you been up to the last week?
What have I been up to? I've been in my house too much, that's for sure.
I think that's the entire population.
Yeah, well, everyone should be saying that, unless you're the people who are assholes who are trying to find a loophole by standing in crowds outside of pubs.
Yeah.
Having your takeaway drinks.
Mm.
That's not how it works, people. And you're making me very jealous.
So mad when I heard about that. It's like, oh yeah, having a takeaway drink, just standing outside the pub. Just like,
yeah,
unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, so other than just generally wanting to be at the pub, I've just been doing uni work and podcast work and looking after the pig. She had her stitches out this morning.
How's she doing?
Yeah. Her stump is looking beautiful. Nice. It's the most beautiful little stump I ever did see. It's very cute. Yeah, she's doing well.
Nice.
Good. How about you? How's your week been going?
Chaos. It's been a very, very busy week this week. I've taught 17 yoga classes in a week.
And oh, shit.
I've done 4 consultations. And my voice has had it. It's had it. So
yeah.
I've drunk a lot of warm liquids to lubricate the old voice box for you lovely people today. So hopefully we'll last. But I'm pretty sure by the end of today, after I've taught my yoga classes this evening, I will be done.
For sure.
Yes.
Need a little resty rest.
Yeah, indeed.
No karaoke for you, young lady.
No karaoke ever for me. Thanks.
Why do people want to do this? Why are people so keen on karaoke? I can't think of anything worse. Yeah,
it's also all karaoke set to be like a key higher, so it makes you shout.
Yeah.
And so that's why you come out of it like, you know?
Yeah.
It's not pretty.
No. I only sing in the comfort of my car. I don't even sing in the shower that much, because my house is full of my siblings and all of that sort of stuff. So it's like my car is the only place that I truly sing. Other than that, nobody will hear me.
We've got this really nice little sweet spot in our flat, which is like sort of the corridor bit between all the rooms, that it's got really good acoustics. And so if you ever watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and Gina on there at one point, she does this thing, she's like, the acoustics are amazing. And I do that all the time. Because I love it. And it's one of my favourite things. Just, you know, like, because in the bathroom, acoustics are really good as well. That's why people sing in the bathroom, because it just vibrates.
Yeah. What have you got to drink and eat today?
I've got a nice bowl of nuts. I really...
A nice bowl of nuts.
I don't know why I said it like that. I'm trying to put an enthusiastic spin on my technology rage. But yeah, a various array of delightful nuts. Almonds, pecans, walnuts.
Got some, all the nuts, hey?
Got some seeds, got some pistachios going in there. No cashews.
What are you drinking today?
It should be wine, B. It should be wine.
I messaged you yesterday and I was like, you said the roles reversed, because I had a glass of wine at lunchtime. Not even proper wine as well. I tried out port. I think I've drunk it before, but port. I didn't realise how strong it was. Port. Fuck me.
Mate.
Why didn't somebody tell me?
Pour that port down my throat in 5 seconds. I fucking love it. Like, get
it's so heaven. Good.
It's so good. So good. It's like, oh, I'm such a grown up now. Mm.
Yeah. Like, I even use, like, I was allowed to use one of the fancy glasses too. you know, like, your parents sometimes have, like, their alcohol stash, mm-hmm. and then nearby they have fancy glasses mm-hmm. that are just for alcohol.
Yeah.
And I'm, not that I'm not allowed to use them, but I feel like there's a sense that I should not use them and that I can stick to the pleb cups. Mm. But I had like port in a fancy glass of wine, which was a mistake because we had a lecture afterwards, which was so interesting, wasn't it? But we'll get onto that later. Mm. But my goodness, a big fan. I feel like an old man in a silk robe now.
What have you got for drinks and snacks?
Oh yeah. I've got a winter berry cordial, like spiced cordial, and it's hot and it's delicious because it's a bit like a non-alcoholic mulled wine. Essentially the vibe I'm going through. Can you sense that I don't like saying the word vibe? That was really painful coming out of my mouth right now.
Vibes.
Just like, no, that's
straight
not
vibes.
That's not me. And then I got a cinnamon apple flapjack.
Jealous.
Yeah, it's pretty yummy.
V, let's talk about AMP, anatomy and physiology, for any new listeners. AMP, anatomy and physiology. Ooh. What have you got for us today?
Two episodes ago, episode 16, Chelsea kicked off our mini series on the cardiovascular system with blood, which is always so interesting. And this week I'm going to talk about the vessels that blood flows through. Blood vessels, if you didn't get that, if that wasn't obvious. So blood vessels are actually active, dynamic organs capable of contracting and expanding, and they deliver oxygen and nutrients to cells throughout the body and carry away waste products and help maintain blood pressure. But firstly, I want to chat about the structure of blood vessels first, because then we have our in our mind how important structure is for later when we talk about function.
Very nice.
Structure, function. Remember. So most of our blood vessels share a similar structure consisting of three layers of tissues called tunics, like a vest type tunic. That's the word spelled like that. Yeah, you get me? Great. And they surround the open space, which is called a lumen. And that's where the blood actually flows through the lumen. So these three tunics consist of the innermost layer, the tunica intima, which has intimate contact with the lumen.
It's like your intimates, like your underwear, your intimates.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like a little silky pair of underwear. And it contains the endothelium, which is made up of simple squamous epithelium tissue, and it's continuous with the lining of the heart. And these cells help form a slick surface to help the blood move without friction. And it's surrounded by the basement membrane, which provides support, and the internal elastic lamina, which separates the tunica intima from the tunica media. And it's very jazzy, the internal elastic lamina. You can imagine it like a piece of Swiss cheese. It's got lots of holes in it, which is also called fenestration. And this allows diffusion through there. So the middle layer. So surrounding the tunica intima is the middle layer, and that's the tunica media. And it's made up of smooth muscle cells and sheets of the protein elastin. The smooth muscle tissue is regulated in part by the nerve fibers of the autonomic nervous system, which can decrease the diameter of the lumen by contracting this middle layer during vasoconstriction or expand it by relaxing during vasodilation. So vasoconstriction is a decrease in the lumen diameter. So it's increased sympathetic stimulation, makes smooth muscle contract, which squeezes the vessel wall and narrows the lumen. And vasodilation is an increase in the lumen diameter. So this can be done by decreased sympathetic stimulation or presence of certain chemicals like nitric oxide or lactic oxide, or in response to blood pressure. And this makes the smooth muscle relax. Mm.
So it's like we talked about it in one of the episodes that I can't quite remember off the top of my head, where it's like if you're really hat your vessels, you have vasodilation so that the blood comes closer to the surface of the skin to release more heat. And if you're really cold, then they'll constrict. So it keeps it, you know, keeping all the heat within your body.
Exactly. And I might touch on that later in capillary action, stuff like that. So you can tell by this, the whole dynamics in the vasoconstriction, vasodilation, that the tunica media plays a key role in blood flow and blood pressure, because the smaller the diameter of the blood vessel, the harder it is for blood to move through it. And then the outermost layer of your blood vessels is the tunica externa, and that's made up of loosely woven collagen fibers that protect and reinforce the whole blood vessel, and this layer anchors the vessel to the surrounding tissues. Fab. Let's go on to the type of blood vessels.
The type of blood?
It's such a jazzy subject, this. I really like it. Because you're just like, if you look at your whole body, there's just so much going on.
So much.
So the types of blood vessels. So the ratio of the thicknesses of the three tunics varies between the type of blood vessels, which allows different functions to happen. This is the sort of functions part of it. The different types of blood vessels. So from the top, you have elastic arteries, muscular arteries, arterioles, capillaries, post-capillary venules, muscular venules, and veins. So let's go through these fellas.
Very nice.
And ladies.
Ooh.
Hoo-hoo. So the big elastic arteries conduct blood from the heart to medium-sized muscular arteries. And these big elastic arteries contain more elastin, if you didn't get that from the name, than any other blood vessel type. So they can absorb the large pressure fluctuation as blood leaves the heart, preventing smaller vessels from getting damaged. So then we go on to muscular arteries that distribute blood to specific parts of the body and taper into these microscopic arterioles that help regulate blood flow from arteries to capillaries. Now, capillaries, they're my favourite.
Oh, yeah. Lie.
So capillaries have only a single layer of epithelial tissue, and this allows exchange of nutrients and waste between blood and interstitial fluid. This is actually called gas exchange, and we'll go into the fun dynamics of this in a later episode because it's a little bit more complex, but it's very important. So instead of a singular vessels like arteries and veins, capillaries can actually form groups called capillary beds, and they're sort of interwoven capillaries. And besides gas exchange, your capillary beds also help regulate blood pressure and play a role in thermoregulation. So I'm just going to go on a small but important side note on capillaries and thermoregulation because I think this is really cool. So you know when you get cold hands, your body is actually protecting you from getting colder when it tightens pre-capillary sphincters. Yes, you have sphincters everywhere that lead to the capillary beds, meaning blood bypasses some capillaries so that the blood is exposed to cold less. And when your fingers go all stiff and numb, it's because the blood vessels are trying to conserve heat. and the smooth muscles around the large arterioles and muscular arteries have squeezed, so they've slowed the flow of blood to the whole hand and it doesn't get as warm. On the other hand, when you're having like a furious game of slapsies, your fingers are working much harder and they're producing more heat. So the capillary sphincters relax and blood flows to the capillary bed and you get nice warm hands.
Mm.
I just thought that was interesting to see how that system actually works when it's like a day-to-day function of like when you feel like you've got cold hands and when you've got really hot hands.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I know loads of people got cold hands, especially in yoga when we do this. Rub your hands together at the end to get heat in your hands. And I've got people that sit there, they're like, blow into their hands, like, warm them up. So their hands are so cold.
Cute. So that's the end of that side tangent. So these capillaries then distribute blood to post-capillary venules. And these post-capillary venules pass blood into muscular venules. And venules in general are super cool because they act as reservoirs for accumulating large volumes of blood. Muscular venules then go into veins, which finally return to the heart. And it's important to remember that after all that hard work, the pressure in veins, the blood is actually 1/12 of that it was in the arteries.
Mm.
So there are clever adaptations like valves in the veins of your arms and your legs, so in your limbs, which help move blood without having backflow. But if these valves have a leak or get damaged or have too much pressure, this is what causes varicose veins, which I think is very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. And together, these make up the extensive network formed a closed system that begins and ends in your heart. So I thought that was jazzy. Oh, and nice. If you strung all of your blood vessels together in a single line, they'd stretch out for 100,000 kilometers, which is about 2.5 times around the Earth.
Holy shit.
And it's just in our little bodies. It's so cool.
It's bloody cool, isn't it? Hey, it's bloody cool.
Oh, look at you.
See, I
you
really am pump. Just an 80-year-old trapped in a 32-year-old's body. I really am.
I love it. It's the best.
Yes. Nice one, dude. I enjoyed that.
Thanks.
That was good.
I'm going to have a wee sip of me cordial. Chelsea,
yeah,
you can tell us about an alternative therapy today.
Yes.
What is it?
Indeedy. Today, we're going to talk about reflexology.
Ooh.
Ooh. Which again, like many of these things that I've investigated, because I've obviously, you know, I've got my monocle and stuff going deep into the investigation. I didn't really know a lot about, never had the treatment personally myself, but I have known of a couple of people that have been really interested in it and said, you know, I've only ever heard good things about it from people that have had it, to be honest. So quite an interesting one. So first up, reflexology is an ancient art, of course, as many of these complementary alternative therapies are, that originated from Chinese and Eastern traditions. It is a non-invasive complementary health therapy based on the theory that different points on the feet, lower leg, hands, face, and ears correspond with different areas of the body.
Sounds familiar.
Yes. It is done using specific techniques, and pressure is applied with the finger, thumb, or whole hand without the use of oil or lotion. There is also evidence that it was used by Egyptians too. So
jazzy.
There's hieroglyphs which show the mapping of the human body onto the feet and stuff.
Oh, cool.
And I think that's super interesting. It would be something I'd really like to look into more, because the Egyptians keep popping up quite a lot with all this stuff. And, you know, you've got all these things like Ayurveda is very Indian. You've got traditional Chinese medicine and stuff, and all these things come from there. But all the time it's like, by the way, the Egyptians did it too. So it would be quite interesting, I think, to look into like the history of medicine within Egypt at some point. I think that would be pretty fun. So whilst the art of reflexology dates back to ancient Egypt, India, China, this therapy wasn't really introduced into the West until Dr. William Fitzgerald developed zone therapy in the early 1900s. He believed that reflex areas of the foot and hands were linked to other areas and organs of the body with the same zone. So in the 1930s, Eunice Ingham further developed this zone therapy into what is known as reflexology in the West now. Her opinion was that congestion or tension in any part of the foot is mirrored in the corresponding part of the body.
Okay.
Interesting, right?
Mm.
The first thing about this that jumped out to me that I found really interesting was I thought reflexology was just the feet.
Same.
But it turns out there's also, this can all be mirrored on like the hands, the face, lower leg, stuff like that as well, which is quite interesting. But all of the kind of research that anyone's done and generally a lot of the sort of information that's out there is about the feet, essentially. And one thing that I hadn't put together is it's called reflexology, as in reflexes. Right?
Yes.
Which I hadn't exactly put that together in my brain. And I was like, oh, reflex. Oh, shit, okay, I've got what we're talking about now. So a Cochrane review defined it as reflexology is a gentle manipulation or pressing on certain parts of the foot to produce an effect elsewhere in the body. So essentially, it's a holistic technique. That's one thing we need to be really clear on. Very holistic. But it's all of the treatment really comes from the foot or the hand or, you know, a different place on the body. So this zone theory is where the body is divided into 10 sections, which is one for each toe. So if you think, imagine just bring a foot into your mind. As V and I were talking earlier, V's not a fan of feet. Not a foot fan.
No.
I'm not that bothered, but dear listener, your choice. You can bring an image of a foot into your brain if you like to. But imagine with each toe a line down. So that's like a different section. And it's not like the body is mirrored from one foot to the other. It's like the whole body crosses both feet.
I see.
Yeah. So you've got like each section of the body kind of goes down there. This kind of follows along the lines of the Chinese theory on meridians as well, which we've talked a little bit about before in some of our other episodes. So all linking back, all these alternative therapies to a very similar theory. So essentially an image of the body can be projected onto the whole of the feet, and in regards to foot reflexology, that is. There are three distinct zones defined by the bone structures under the foot. So the bone structures of the body can be linked to the bone structures of the foot. So the shoulder line, so if you think where your shoulders are, is like the top of your foot. So it separates your toes, essentially.
Okay, yeah.
You've got the shoulder line and the pelvic line. So the pelvic line is like coming towards the bottom of the foot. So we can separate the body into these sections. So if you think about the bone structure... You think about the bone structure of the foot, you've got the toes, the ball of the foot, the arch of the foot, and the heel of the foot, just to like really simplify it and summarize it. So the toes have got the reflexes for like your head and neck. The ball of the foot houses the reflexes around your thorax, so where you've got like your lungs and your heart. The arch of the foot is you've got your abdomen, essentially. And then coming towards the heel of the foot, you've got like your pelvic area. So you're literally mapping out the body as it kind of goes down the foot. And remembering that there is one side of the body on each foot. So if you think about the digestive tract, for example, but if you've got 2 feet looking at you, look at those pretty feet, and then you've got the large intestine that goes across one and across to the other. So you move from one foot over to the other to massage the whole of the large intestine.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it? And also, so there's a bit more of your heart on your left foot than there is on your right foot, because it's just slightly leans over to the left. I thought that was quite cool. It's quite interesting.
Very.
So at the start of a treatment, a therapist will generally take a full case history, and initially they massage the head. This is kind of the idea on that the mind controls everything, and they want the mind to be relaxed before stimulating the feet. And the techniques aim to decrease these energy blockages around the body and increase circulation. So this is something I think we've talked about a lot in terms of like acupuncture and all these other different therapies. It's like it's all about reducing these blockages of energy and unblocking the channels, making sure everything's running nice and smooth, and increasing circulation to that area, getting more blood. We've been talking about blood and stuff quite a lot. You've got all your nutrients, oxygen and stuff in there. A therapist will use these different techniques to stimulate these areas, which helps provide overall relaxation and stress reduction to these organs, which, let's face it, everyone needs less stress in their life. Everyone needs less stress. So back in the 1920s, investigative studies regarding the concept allowed the first Western reflexology foot map to be produced. I think we've all probably seen pictures of this stuff, right? Of like that, you know, the foot with all the different like colours and things like that on it. And since that time, the other anatomical areas have been mapped, allowing this model to be applied to hands, ears and face. Anyone can get reflexology, including babies. Baby reflexology, which I think is super cute. There are certain times that reflexology might not be suitable, so it's always worth talking to a reflexologist, and they'll obviously be able to tell you if it's worth you getting treatment or not. The Association of Reflexologists, which is an organisation based in the UK, is very, very clear that they are a complementary therapy. So they're not an alternative therapy. They are definitely complementary. The difference, again, being that complementary is you do it alongside your allopathic medical care. And alternative is you do it without allopathic medical care. And it should not be used instead of medical treatment and only alongside your medical treatment. Reflexologists do not prescribe or diagnose. They are strictly providing treatment. They are very focused on treating holistically and take the whole person, mind and body into account. Which I think is good, that they've been very open about that, you know?
Yeah, that makes it very clear as well. Like the aim of reflexology isn't, they're not claiming, like yet again, it's showing that all of the people who are like, these people are quacks and like they're trying to like put people down like a dark path and take away from modern medicine. Like nobody's actually saying that.
Mm.
They're offering it as a complementary treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. They're offering to reduce stress inside the body. Great. Mm. Love it. Let's go for it.
Ideal.
Indeed. So there has been some positive research projects carried out on reflexology. However, as yet, there's not a large enough body of evidence for them to make clinical claims on the effectiveness, essentially. So, as always, with all this stuff, more research, please.
Yeah.
With the ever-increasing levels of stress in everyday life, it is important for people to take more responsibility of their own healthcare needs, right? That's what we're talking about all the time. So, reflexology can definitely be one of those ways to help mitigate stress in the modern life, essentially, which is what they talk about, which I think is a great way of looking at it. And sounds really interesting to me as well. One of the things that they do in terms of treatments quite a lot is where we were talking about before, the large intestine and rolling over from one foot to the other. It's like things with like constipation and stuff. So it's like you're massaging the gut. I know some people, I don't know how true this is, but I know some people said that a reflexologist has been able to tell when someone's pregnant from, because they're, because of their palpation skills and how sensitive they are to the areas of the body, and they can feel different changes within the foot. They were able to tell that they were pregnant, which is crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really impressive.
Yeah. So yeah, it would be interesting to know more about that too. But yeah, again, if you're a reflexologist and you'd like to tell us more about it, do get in touch.
Yeah. Let us know.
Yeah. I do think once the pandemic is subsided, we should definitely do a Chelsea and V goes and gets all the treatments.
I really, really want to get this done.
Yeah.
This week, as we said at the beginning, our minds are a little bit blown and we thought that we would just have some osteopathy chats.
Yeah.
We've just been in uni. We've got lots on our mind.
Mm.
Let's see where this discussion takes us.
Yes. That's one thing that I was really happy to see, though, is that in all of the schools from the very beginning, they allowed women.
I'm really proud about that aspect of the history of osteopathy.
Yeah, me too. Like, especially if you think like, so when was it? It was like 18 something, late 1800s, essentially, we'll call it.
Yeah.
You think about, you know, modern medicine at that time.
Yeah.
There's no way they'd let a woman be a doctor.
No.
You had midwives and things like that, but were still considered, you know, very not as well trained or not able to do things that men were able to do and stuff like that. It was, I think, really, really refreshing to see that AT still was really welcoming of women within the profession. And I think just looking at pictures of him, he just looks like a nice human.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
The fact that he like just really liked being his farming gear as well. He just wanted to be like outdoors and not in like suits and stuff like that. And he wanted to be like really honest with his practice.
Mm.
Oh yeah, how do you feel about asking patients about systemic health? So about how their diet is and how their bowels are working, all of that sort of stuff.
Mm. I think I'm okay with doing it because it's one thing with yoga and Ayurveda, yoga therapy anyway, and Ayurveda is that I ask people that anyway.
I'm interested in, obviously, as somebody who identifies as female, I'm interested in female health.
Yeah.
And I find it very interesting that actually very little is spoken about menopause.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. Very little is spoken about menopause. I know that my mum's had her a very difficult time with the menopause and all of that sort of stuff. And I know of people who've had hysterectomies and all of those sorts of things. But I have actually had very little conversations about what it's actually like to go through the menopause, what it's like to have a hysterectomy, how you actually feel about how you feel after the menopause.
Yeah.
And what your actual health is like afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think it's from back in the day, and even when we were kids and we're told about periods, is that the girls were taken separately and the boys were, you know, you go and do a fun thing, we're going to tell the girls about periods now. And that it's almost like, don't tell the boys about it because they can't deal with it. And I think it's almost that thing of that if you think people going through their menopause now in their 40s, 50s, 60s, very much ingrained, and we can't talk about this stuff because it's very specific to women. And every woman that I've come across who's gone through the menopause has a fucking shit time of it. And I was like,
yeah,
because we get told when you have the menopause, your period stops.
Yeah, it sounds like a party.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah.
And we're like, great. We're not told about all the shit that has to go with it. Like, in terms of going through that process, my aunt and my cousin on my maternal side have both had hysterectomies as well.
Yeah.
And I know that my mum, hey, mum, I know you're listening, has a horrible time with the menopause. But it's the thing, isn't it? There's not enough research into it and understanding how we can support women through that. So I'd be really interested to do more research on that myself. Because I don't think we really get taught much about the physiology of what happens through menopause either.
No. No. And actually, it was very interesting when we were learning about the anatomy of, in general, anatomy books very rarely show female bodies as like dissected forms or like pictures and diagrams and stuff like that. It's very rare for it to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And the section in so many websites and books and stuff like that is so small about how the female reproductive system works and how hormones work. I still haven't found a really good, concise explanation for how hormones work in the menstrual cycle, which really frustrates me because I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah. But yeah, that as well. And another thing in regards to women's health and things is that because taking this case history, talking about systemic health, one thing I thought, one of the questions we got asked is, so obstructions to taking case history, like, is there anything that you see? And one thing I thought of is that if, say, for example, you've got a patient who's transgender, who's trans, who's a trans man, that potentially is living as a man, but has still not had any surgery or might not be taking hormones or something like that, where they're still menstruating, it might be really triggering for them to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Especially as they've grown up not believing that they should have been a man but born as a woman. I feel like that could be quite challenging, but also I imagine at the same time quite essential to us understanding what's going on in their body in terms of their systemic health.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure how that would be approached. It would be really good, especially because have you seen this book Mind the Gap that's come out?
Which, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, which is it was a black medical student, I think he was in his third year, and realised that all of the pictures in medical textbooks about skin diseases were all on white skin and not on coloured skin at all, so not on black skin, people of colour, like anything at all. So he created his own book. Amazing. I'd be really interested. Yeah. And he's put it up online for free as well. You can download the PDF for free.
Oh my God.
Which is incredible.
That's amazing that he's done it for free as well.
I think that's really amazing because a lot of our textbooks and things that we have to buy are incredibly expensive and they make it really inaccessible. A lot of it,
yeah.
The fact that these textbooks are so expensive, like this amazing osteopathy book is £130. How ridiculous is that? I understand a lot of time, effort and work has to go into it, but you're really cutting the barrier who's able to actually buy that book. But it would be really interesting to see if there is some more medical books, medical textbooks and things that come out that address these gaps that we have in terms of dealing with minorities and making sure that we're making them feel comfortable and in a safe environment. I'd be really interested to see if there's more of those or, you know, finding a way to try and facilitate them or something.
Yeah, it's just like how obviously, well, not obviously, because our listeners don't know me, but I don't have any children, and I'm not currently pregnant, but I've been reading quite a bit about women's health in general, and obviously breastfeeding comes into that, and the gaps in how much support is given to women of colour in breastfeeding is really upsetting. It's really upsetting to me in general. And I know that breastfeeding is a very difficult subject for a lot of women because people feel like it's such an integral part of your first of steps in being a mum. But there's so little support for women of colour in breastfeeding, and it's almost like it's not given to them as an option. And if it is given to them as an option, it's almost insinuated that I need to do more reading into it. It's almost insinuated like they are given the option, but if it doesn't work first time, they're almost like, oh yeah, like you won't want to do it anyways because of the percentages that are obviously biased that they've collected in statistics. So it's like yet another way that they are not given enough support. And it's like, I hope that in the future, in the very soon future, that these gaps can start being addressed.
But yes, gaps can start being filled. Let's pave the way. One other thing on, you know, textbooks just showing male, white male bodies, essentially, generally, is, for example, one of the things that we went through this weekend is the respiratory exam. Which the example we were shown was obviously a man with his top off on, and we're doing percussion things and using the stethoscope. And I'm like, that's all well and good. How do we do that on a woman? Making sure she feels comfortable and that she's not exposed. Because I know personally for me in the past, I've had an ECG where you have to take your top off and you're led there, you know, topless on a bed with all these different things on. And I was with the doctor who was doing it, and someone opened the door and came into the room and stuff. Like, they didn't lock the door, and not a very nice experience. So it's just kind of, okay, so what do we need to do to make sure we're making that patient feel comfortable? And also, is it a case of if you're a male practitioner, do you need to make sure, you know, talking them through and just kind of like, would you like to have a female practitioner do this exam and things like that, you know? Because that's the thing, it's like they're great. It's like, oh yeah, you just need to keep the patient's modesty. Great, talk us through that. Talk us through that and make us understand how we need to do that.
Yeah, you know? Because at one point in the respiratory exam, the practitioner had his hands around the rib cage, essentially like two fingers down from the male, like actor patient's nipple. And it was like surrounding the rib cage, and you're feeling how their rib cage expand and come in. And it's like, for a woman, if you're doing that, you're right underneath her breast tissue.
Yeah.
So you're essentially cupping her boobs. Like, I don't know about you, but we've already heard about how many people are sort of like caught out and are like, oh, this osteopath did like a strange technique and they might not have explained it to me. Or like, not just osteopath, but doctors, GPs, like loads. And like they did this thing without explaining it to me, or they didn't understand the explanation and they felt really uncomfortable and vulnerable. And it's like, that to me is an extremely vulnerable position to be in.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a case of obviously, like, you know, part of, you know, society making us feel uncomfortable in those situations, but it's not going to change rapidly and we can't help how people feel. But it would be good for us to have training in terms of not just this is how you do a respiratory exam textbook, you know, do this, do this, do this. It's like, let's talk about how we engage with the patient. You know what I mean? And it's like, okay, let's talk about, and even it's like, right, we're going to go through your respiratory exam, blah, blah, blah. Okay, what issues can you see coming up with this? If you've got a patient that comes in, let's give you five examples of a patient, different patients or whatever, that come into your clinic. This, are you able to do this respiratory exam? Is there anything you think that might be uncomfortable for the patient? You know, sort of case study stuff like that, I think would be really, really good generally. In helping prepare us for that.
Quite a few times, teachers or osteopaths or people that we've been speaking to have sort of been like, I can't tell you the exact words to use. And I completely get that. But when you're coming to potentially awkward, vulnerable examinations or techniques or stuff like that, I would really love if any of our listeners are osteopaths or practitioners who potentially do techniques that are a more awkward area. I would love to know how you approach those and how you communicate with your patients. Because it is something that I think is really important to me and to Chelsea. And I would love to know a bit more about how you get on with that process. Maybe we'll learn it in the next couple of years and they'll expand on it, but would love to know more now. If anyone would like to contact us.
For sure. Do get in touch.
It's medical story time. Woo! Do you love my tone deaf singing?
Hey.
Anyways.
You got beautiful voice. Beautiful.
Thanks, Mum. Right. Today it's medical story time and Chelsea's going to tell us what the story is.
Yes. So, last week, you'll remember, if you listened, dear listener, V was telling us a lovely tale about smoke enemas and blowing smoke up people's asses and all this sort of stuff. So if you haven't listened, I would go back because it was a lot of fun to hear and it, you know, it would just put a little smile on your face. And so during that conversation, you'll remember that Rosanna mentioned, did they not know CPR? Right, and none of us had an answer for it at all. We were just like, oh, no, maybe not. When did CPR start? Who knows? I don't know. So I thought it'd be interesting this week for us to explore the history of CPR.
Whoop whoop.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in this.
Yes. So now with all of these sorts of things, and you probably notice a pattern, it's difficult for us to identify the exact point of when something like this happens, because it's not like someone wakes up and one is like, CPR. This is how we do it. It's like someone, you know, there's been different things that have done in a similar or smaller way. And eventually someone brings all this stuff together and creates the ultimate version of it, which is essentially what happened with CPR. So first up, what does it even stand for? Cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Cardio being heart, pulmonary being lungs. And this is the key thing of when we think about CPR in its modern way, is the cardiopulmonary aspects, these dual aspects. So I think it's a good way for us to remind ourselves of why are we performing CPR in the first place. Okay, it's to revive or to resuscitate someone, which is where V's tale last week was all about. You know, they were looking at how they resuscitate someone, revive them. And a lot of the early methods were really focused purely on respiration by putting more air and therefore more oxygen into the body. In the 1500s, they used bellows. So V talks about this last week as well. So you know with those things that you just like pump and you push more air into the fire and whatever. So it's literally pushing more air. They used that to into a patient's mouth, essentially. And so this was so more air would go into their lungs. And this was the primary practice for the next 300 years.
What? 300?
Yeah. So from 1500 to like the late 1700s, early 1800s, this was like the primary practice. A bit crazy. So Now, here's a quick timeline of a few things that happened along the road to developing the modern way of doing CPR that we know today. So in 1740, the French Academy of Sciences recommended mouth-to-mouth resuscitation specifically for victims of drowning. So a lot of all of this stuff came from people that were drowning. How can we save them? Again, all of this stuff, it's like we haven't really got any figures on how effective any of this was, how many patients were saved and all of this sort of thing. It is a bit crazy.
Sorry, I need resuscitation.
Do you not think it's funny that the French suggested the mouth to mouth?
Yeah, I do think it's quite funny.
In a really cliche way.
Yeah, it is quite funny. Then almost 151 years later, in fact, Dr. Friedrich Mass performed the first equivocally documented case of chest compressions in a human. So before that, the only time some form of something was to do with the heart, getting the heart involved into this, was when would be like in surgery where they would like crack someone's chest open, put their hand in and massage the heart. But this was getting to a point where we were starting to look at it externally. So rather than a very invasive procedure of like ripping someone's ribs apart, it's a case of, okay, what can we do on the outside of the body? So in 1903... Dr. George Creil, C-R-I-L-E, reported the first successful use of external chest compressions. So in 1903, it was the first time chest compressions were ever used successfully.
That's so recent.
I know, isn't it? It's crazy. It gets even more recent. I was kind of a little bit like, how is it only this, you know, this sort of timeline that these things happened? It was in the 1950s. Is when things really started to get moving. James L. modified the practice for mouth-to-mouth resuscitation in 1954, and he proved that expired air was sufficient to maintain adequate oxygen. So this is really important, as it means that the air that one person breathes out and then into another person had enough oxygen in it to help oxygenate the blood of the patient. So that's one thing that was really important. And in 1960, the process of CPR is officially developed. So it's only in 1960. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's crazy. So this was pivotal of all of these different techniques coming together. So you had some people doing this mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, other people doing these chest compressions and stuff. And basically, they pulled it all together and realized cardiopulmonary resuscitation is the important thing. You've got to get the oxygen into the blood. You've got to get that blood pumping around the body. That's the thing that's really important. So that oxygen can be delivered to all your lovely cells. And this is the main reason we do CPR. It's to keep oxygen flowing to the brain until medical help can arrive. That's the main purpose of it. So if you see, you know, someone's had a heart attack, they've collapsed on the street, blood isn't flowing around their body. You essentially are mimicking that action of pushing oxygen around the body, mainly to the brain is the most important thing we're thinking of here, until official medical help can arrive. And therefore save the person. So that's the important thing. In 1966, the first guidelines of CPR were published, which are pretty not too different to what they are today, essentially. Pretty similar.
Oh, really? Mm.
It's the old ABC.
Yeah.
The ABC. Airway, breathing, circulation. So airway, you want to tip their head back to make sure that when you breathe into them, it's not going into the stomach, it's going into the lungs. Breathing, the mouth-to-mouth, and circulation, the compressions. So that's kind of what we're looking at here with it.
There's in airway that there's no obstructions in the mouth.
Yes, indeed, indeed. When I had my training, it was Dr. ABC, as in, first of all, you look for danger. So if someone's unconscious on the floor, you look for danger to make sure that there's no danger around, because you can't put yourself in danger because pointless.
Yeah.
Response, so you need to say hello, can you hear me? And see if there's a response. Then airways, you check their airways. Breathing, you check that they're breathing. Circulation, you check their circulation. But the first thing that was released in 1966 was literally as an ABC, as in you do the airway, you do the breathing, then you do the circulation. So I think it's quite interesting how that's all sort of similar things for it, but it's kind of all evolved essentially. It wasn't until 1972 that the world's first mass CPR CPR training program took place. 1972.
Wow.
Crazy, right?
Yeah.
But it certified more than 100,000 people in its first 2 years.
Wow.
Crazy, right? And then the next level up was in the 1990s when AEDs, which are automatic external defibrillators,
replaced. They're very good.
Yeah, were placed around public places. Have you seen one? Do you know if you've got one?
Yeah, with nursing training and all of that sort of stuff. I've practiced with them.
Yeah. Have you seen them in the street though?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's one thing is that after I had my training, I just see them everywhere now. Like I always see them in the street and it's things that you never noticed before. But dear listener, if you haven't seen one or you're not totally sure of what it is that we're talking about, essentially it's something that will give a shock to the heart to help restart the heart. They're really great. They are literally everywhere. And there is a website that you can go and check out if you're interested, if you wanted to know where your closest AED is. But it's if you just search kind of AED locations in Google, it'll find it for you. And then finally, moving into kind of late 2000s, early 2010s, do you remember, V, I've got a question for you. Do you remember the Vinnie Jones CPR advert?
No, I haven't.
So
I don't think I saw that. He's a legend, isn't he?
So there's going to be some people listening to this now laughing because they remember it. There's going to be others that are like, what are you talking about? Do yourself a favour, get on YouTube and put in Vinnie Jones CPR and you'll be able to watch it. But essentially, it's something that started to come around. It was happening in America a little bit earlier than it was in the UK, where essentially it was talking about hands-only CPR. And this is because generally a lot of people didn't want to do CPR. They didn't want to do the mouth-to-mouth bit. So it was to encourage more people to do hands-only CPR. Because that's essentially the most important point if you're doing the compressions, because it creates almost like a bit of a passive inhale. So you are getting a little bit of oxygen into the lungs. Not as much, obviously, as doing mouth-to-mouth, but it's doing the job. It's the most important thing. And it was done to the pattern of the Bee Gees song, Staying Alive.
Yeah, that's how I learned it.
And the reason why that is because generally, if you're in that sort of situation, you've got a lot of adrenaline pumping around your body, hella adrenaline. And so sometimes people can go too fast, and going too fast means the heart hasn't got an opportunity to refill with blood. And so you're just, you know, it's completely ineffective. But the Vinnie Jones app is quite funny. It's like, just push hard and deep because better a cracked rib than the fact that he's dead and stuff like that.
Honestly, apparently so many people, one of my colleagues is an ex-paramedic and he's like, I've cracked loads of people's ribs doing CPR.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. And it's better that they're alive, right? It's better that they're
exactly
alive. Yeah, that's the most important thing. And so since we've talked a little bit about it before, you know, give you a bit of a breakdown of what the key is in terms of what you need to deliver. But it is also always really important if you really want to know about it, to go and get a certified course. There are hundreds everywhere.
Yeah.
You'll be able to find one. Right. Lots of employers provide them and things like that. And also if you do actually run a company and you can get, you know, nice and cheap to train all your staff. But one thing that's really interesting is that there are some countries that train everyone, the whole population, in how to do it. And in that instance, apparently I think it was 70 to 80% of people that collapse get CPR because you know, it's like everyone's trained in it. In countries like ours, it's only about 20% of people that collapse get CPR. Oh,
that's quite scary, isn't it?
It is quite scary. But it is good to know that 92,000 people in the UK a year are saved from CPR. So, and that's with only 20% of people getting it. So it's like, you know, imagine if we all got trained in it and we all started doing it.
Yeah, they should do it at schools.
Yeah.
I think like 16-year-olds could get trained in it.
The first time I ever did my training in it was I used to go, there was like a summer school club thing that we could go to, and basically they did like day out trips and things like that. And the way you got to go on day out trips to like theme parks and stuff for free was if you did mini training courses. So I was like 15 and did a first aid training course and got to go to Drayton Manor for free. Like, I think that's a great idea.
What a reward system.
I know, but what a great idea to inspire kids to do stuff, I think, in like these training courses.
Definitely.
But yes.
Yeah.
So couple of key tips from your friendly neighbourhood pals, Chelsea and V, on how to perform your CPR. V's definitely probably got more experience with this than I have, no doubt. I have done like so many first aid training courses. Never had to give CPR though, personally.
Yeah, neither have I, which is a good thing.
Yeah. So first key is obviously you need to check to make sure that there is, if there is breathing or if there is a pulse at the time. If you're tilting the head back and they're making a very noise, you probably need to breathe into them. But the key is to tilt the head back, because otherwise if you don't tilt it back and you do mouth to mouth, it's just going to go into their stomach. It's not going to go into their lungs. And you want to check if there's any obstruction of the airway. To do the actual compressions itself, it's a case of you want to bring one hand over the other and you want to lock your elbows. And with that, lifting your knuckles up, you want to push into the center of the chest and you want to push with your body. Don't push with your hands. Don't push with your arms. Push with your body, because otherwise if you're pushing with your hands, you're going to get tired real, real quick. It's a key to push with your body. And you want to go down to kind of like 5 to 6 centimeters, roughly about 2 inches. So it's quite forceful. It's quite a lot of force.
It's a lot more force than you think.
Yeah, for sure. And you want to remember to pump to the rhythm of something like Staying Alive, because it's about 100 beats per minute, essentially, in terms of the tempo of the song. And you don't want to go too fast, like you said. V, you got any other tips to add in?
Just so you know, CPR for children and for infants and babies is different to adults.
Yes.
But if you want to know more, you could download the Red Cross app. They have an app for both adults emergency situations, and it covers things and it will talk you through how to do CPR. And there's an infant and like baby and children one, and it will talk you how to do that as well, which is very good. I have them both on my app because I'm paranoid.
Very smart. Always good to be prepared.
Yeah.
Cool. So
that was really interesting though.
In a nutshell. Yeah, I couldn't believe it was that recent. You know, it's one of those things that you thought has always been around.
That's mad, isn't it?
It is mad. Mad. But yeah, go check out some local training. Go check out where all your AEDs are. Be prepared.
I love that. Lion King.
Always Lion King.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you so much. We hope you enjoyed it. We've enjoyed having you.
I still find it so weird that like I can't see or can't hear any of the reactions to when people are listening.
I know. So some of our fellow students have said that apparently they talk back to us. We're doing the podcast, which I think is quite funny. I like that.
I really appreciate it. Yeah. But if you'd like to tell us what you thought of this episode, you can email us at TTOOSpodcast@gmail.com or contact us on social media, which is TTOOS podcast. I say every week, why is it different? Oh, I need a nap.
It's all good. Yeah. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for listening as always. We love you very much. And we will see you next time.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.